You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I've been looking forward to recording this podcast ever since I finished her book. Dr. Dana Suskind is the New York Times bestselling author of Parent Nation and 30 Million Words. She is the founder and co-director of the TMW Center for Early Learning and Public Health, founding director of the Pediatric Cochlear Implant Program, and professor of surgery and pediatrics at the University of Chicago. She has a remarkable new book. It's called Human Raised, Nurturing Connection, Curiosity, and Lifelong Learning in the Age of AI. Enjoy the pod. Dana, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
One of the most important tenets of improvisation is the idea that everything you do is correct. You learn to see all obstacles as gifts, and you make mistakes work for you. These are the adages of this work. And I gave a TEDx talk once where the business example I used was the fact that we frame hate mail and put it on the walls of our lobby at Second City. And that's in Chicago. And the thing that I've realized about AI, as I've been sort of exposed to it over the years, is that it is terrible at being wrong, and specifically terrible at being wrong with intention and utility. And there's a passage in your new book where you write, quote, "Moments in which connection is briefly disrupted and then restored teach children that relationships can withstand mistakes and misalignments." And this isn't just the flawed mother in me talking. Imperfection might be the most important missing ingredient in human AI interactions. The adaptive, messy qualities of human back and forth create three critical development opportunities, end quote. And you go on to name the three. You say frustration tolerance, reading the room, push and pull. All of these are skills you learn as an improviser, learning to work in a group without a script.
Yeah, and clearly after this beautiful invitation and sort of reflecting on improv, I realized that early childhood is the foundations for being a good improv comedian or actor. Those are, and for me, that was the biggest revelation, because I've been in early childhood. It's about human connection for building a child's brain. But I don't think until I really wrote this book and reflected on this age of AI and its beautiful, you know, frictionless interaction, how powerful friction and all those missteps and messy interactions are for building our human capabilities.
So you came here a couple weeks ago to see our mostly improvised show Reality Detox. And I talked to Nick Epley about this because my wife Anne directed it, and she very much used Epley's work on self-disclosure with the cast talking about things that they'd experienced. And I don't know what was said the night you were there, but every night I've been at the show, it is remarkable the things that people say and tell.
It was, first of all, just to be clear, we actually had our book launch party for my entire team at Second City Improv, because I thought, you know, what better way to celebrate the power of messy human interaction than at Second City? And it did not disappoint. It was so much fun. And I can tell you some of the things that were disclosed, even by the people on my team. I was like, oh.
You learned some things.
I was like, oh, even. But it was so much fun. And by the way, at some point I have to tell you my idea, or maybe I should tell your wife, idea for another improv show for parents with kids. You can call it, you know, I don't know, please silence your children or something like that. You can bring the kid. But yeah, no, it's the improv is the one thing, not the one thing, the one of many things that AI will never, ever be able to replace.
No, because in many ways, when we were all talking here about what this show might be, and I'm not an AI doomer, and you're not, and you actually aren't either. No. But you know, also I didn't want screens. We didn't want screens. We didn't want an AI show. We wanted something specifically that wouldn't be ever confused with that. And it because so much of what is happening is only happening because it happened in the room in that moment between the people who are there, and like the title of the show, it happens at the end of the show. because you're trying to sum it, right? And so you're like, oh, we're, and you become a community almost. Like there's like, it's almost like the ensemble extends from the people on stage to the audience. And there is friction and things aren't perfect, but that's delightful. And the clean lines of AI are tough. With regard to attempting to replicate what happens in real life, and I think that people don't always understand that the mess is part of the point.
Yeah, I think that the smooth lines and the frictionless of AI has made all of us like hunger not just for a human connection, but the messy DIY of real human art, you know, whether it be on stage or, you know, in the physical world. And actually, that's why I insisted that the cover, the patch, was actually made by a Chicago-based artist. And the beauty is just the imperfection. And it's true. At the end of the show at Second City, it felt like a large relationship. We were all part of it. And it was just something to behold. And when they said at the beginning, you know, the show that you will be part of and you'll see, it will never happen again. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly true. It could never. And it was just, you wanted to bottle it up, but of course you can't. And that's one of the beautiful parts of it. So, and by the way, the name of the show at the end was, they called it Human Raised because my husband had talked about me
I don't think anyone gave them necessarily the heads up either.
They didn't know. They didn't. It was only because of my loudmouth, wonderful husband who, you know, and there were many other names, but they didn't even know I was going to be on the show. So I was sort of happy. I took a picture of it. So.
I love it. So the introduction of the book really resonated with me as well. You write that, quote, "For years, I dreamed of silence." And then you say, "I didn't wish for that. I don't wish for that anymore." And you make a striking comparison when you write, quote, "In Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the revolutionary book that sparked the modern environmental movement, the birds that no longer sang weren't the tragedy. They were the signal, a warning that something essential was dying. I hear a similar warning now in a different kind of silence, the eerie algorithm-induced quiet of children transfixed by technology," end quote. That is profound. I'm curious for you, like, is that one of those things that you discovered as you were writing it? Is it like, what was it? Because your work, of course, is, you know, about you live in both silence and noise and this. So when did the idea that the Silent Spring comparison, all of that come to you?
Yeah. You know, it is, you know, I'm a pediatric physician, a cochlear implant surgeon. It's true. In the operating room, there is much more silence, although we all talk. But the clinics that I take care of children and their families in the past have always been, as I said, you know, this rambunctious symphony of babies crying, laughing, you know, parents try to navigate it. And in the last few years, there's been this, as I mentioned, this strange quieting. And it's something that you sort of notice, but you don't really notice. But then as you're writing, you're like, oh, my goodness, this is, you know, this has been happening. And it's sort of, you don't even notice it because it's a gradual thing. It sort of slips in. And there's no doubt that people talk about it's all that people seem to be able to talk about is AI. But the one area that they're not talking about is the impact of AI on the developing human, you know, and in that same way, I wanted to sort of juxtapose the huge environmental emergency of climate, you know, on the future of our Earth to the huge impact that, you know, AI can have on the developing human. So, you know, if you're not careful, the idea of improv could not be a thing in the future, depending on how children, you know, develop, because it's not just about learning. It's learning to connect and be okay with messy human interaction and flow with it. But if all you've ever had is that frictionless AI companion or as part of it, it could change. It could change Second City if we're not careful. And we can't.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want that to change. One of the things you talk about, I just experienced, and this is a very positive around AI. So maybe 8-9 years ago, I got diagnosed with a heart murmur. Turned out I had a leaky valve, and I just had open heart surgery on March 12th, and everything's great. You know, it was all great. But the difference from 8 years ago in my cardiologist's office and with my other doctors while they're typing away at a computer compared to the last year where they weren't doing that, where they were looking me in the eye because, of course, they were using AI technology to record everything that was being said. It was dramatic. And it was kind of what I needed, because when we got to the big surgery, it was a big deal. I felt cared for in a way that I don't know that I felt previously when I was being sort of diagnosed and written about on a screen.
Yeah. I mean, so as mentioned, I am far from anti-tech. I'm far from anti-AI. I'm a cochlear implant surgeon. I embed technology. I actually do, at the research center that I co-direct at the University of Chicago, I do AI research. I build AI. So I am far from I'm not pro or anti. I'm about how do you use AI in ways that support human flourishing, connection, feeling cared for. And one of the stories that I tell in the book is about exactly that. In medicine, you know, there was huge burnout, huge exhaustion by even doctors, because we go into it to care for people because we actually care. We want to be able to care. And electronic medical records had totally changed the calculus. I mean, suddenly we were on our computers. We had no eye contact with our patients as we were taking the history, filling out the forms. We had to take work home. It was, you know, really exhausting. And AI, this is where I think AI can really help allow for greater presence. These AI scribes, and we have at the University of Chicago now, AI is working in the background. I mean, nothing's perfect, but it works in the background. I can connect with you as a as a patient or as a parent, and it's taking the notes. It's helping me, you know, with the coding and diagnostic. I mean, I'm still in the driver's seat. I still need to look at it, you know, because it's far from perfect. But that is a way that we should be thinking about AI. How can it lift up the invisible burdens that pull us from the presence that we so want? Because we are a distinctly social species. We want to connect. Go into medicine to care for you, Kelly, not to, you know, be a, you know, a transcriber. So I love that example, and it's how we should do it everywhere.
Yeah. The specific moment I just remembered, and this was just a few weeks ago, so met with a cardiologist to basically have all the good news, right? Like, my scans are great, my numbers are great, all that's all good. But I've been having some stuff with my fingers, a little bit of numbness and some other stuff, which I think might be the blood thinners. And literally, he's like, oh, look at your hands. And he for the first time, I think, ever touched my hands. and was like, oh, have you got arthritis? I can see. Have you seen anyone? And I goes, well, I talked to my doctor. There's not that much I can do. But it was profound. And I don't know if you know this. When about a decade ago, when we were working with Nick and the team up at University of Chicago around behavioral science and improv, the thing called the Second Science Project, I had gotten connected with my now dear friend, Ai-Jen Poo, and we worked with the Cleveland Clinic. Yes, right. So we created an improvisation for caregivers program together that we launched at Aspen Ideas Festival, and we did for years at the Las Vegas branch of the Cleveland Clinic. And the idea that improv as a tool for care, I would never have thought of. And just Jen got it right away. She's like, nope, this is the idea of being fiercely present in the moment, the idea that we are all an ensemble. And there's a really striking few words that a roboticist said to you. It's Matthias Schoetz. He told you that the biggest missing piece in all of artificial intelligence is that none of the machines care.
Yeah. You know, what is so clear is AI's capabilities continue to up like this, you know, reasoning, creation of new products, if you will, think computation, math. But the one thing that AI can't do, it can't, doesn't stay up at night worried about you, Kelly, and how things are going to go through the surgery, and being so thankful that you're doing well, or, you know, your child, how they're doing, and, you know, the lost potential of many children. So I think that in some ways the age of AI will also allow us, as a mirror to us, allow us to see the beauty of what is distinctly human. And I think the idea of caring, especially, you know, we all care in many different realms, but caring of parents and caregivers to their children, it's remarkable. It's inexplicable in some ways. It defies, you know, real understanding, but it is an amazing thing. So we need to harness those wonderful aspects of us.
Yeah, this is something I was talking to Nick about, because the books and the conversations all sort of happened at the same time. And this is a really hard time of year for me and my family, because we lost our daughter Nora about 8 years ago to cancer. July 10th was her birthday. Her death day is August 1st. And we during that period would run into Nick at Lurie because he was going through his stuff. You've gone through your stuff. And one of the things I said to him, having read at that point your book, his book, knowing these worlds that we've all inhabited, which is like, I don't want the grief. I don't want the trauma. I would rather have her here. However, there is important lessons to be learned in terms of how you move forward in the world with that. And the biggest thing for me is that I get hired, probably like you, I do a lot of speaking. You know, I go to a lot of conferences. I always talk about Nora. I don't shy away from it. And inevitably, someone in that audience comes up afterwards and is like, can I give you a hug? And it's because they've had that loss too. And they don't have jobs that allow them to talk about it. And I have not lived in a world yet where AI can even begin to touch what that is.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
100%. And I'm so sorry about Nora. Mm-hmm. You know, in some ways I do the same. I mean, you know, I tell the story of my late husband, Don, and as a way to not just honor his legacy, but he continues forward with me in my life. And so, yes, he's part of the introduction of the book where, you know, after Matthias shared about original intentionality and the revelation that AI doesn't care, and telling the story of Don, who, you know, who lost his life drowning in St. Lake, Michigan. He was saving two children, and really sharing that story as a way to inspire others, not just about caring. Obviously, we care about our own children in ways that nothing else can compare, but sort of pushing ourselves to see all children as worthy and deserving of our care, both from a caring standpoint and a pragmatic standpoint, because we as a human species don't live and die. We live and die as a communal, not as an individual. So And just so you know, my daughter is getting married at Labor Day, and I'm you know, in terms of bringing Don along the journey, I'm trying to sort of think about my by this time, well, I guess the speech won't have been done yet. I'm trying to think about how to give a speech for both of us. And I think about how, like, there are all these AI, I know we're getting off topic, all these AI, like, grief bots. And I'm like, oh, no, it needs to live in your brain. And I need to, like, figure out how to share, how he can be part of that speech. So I'm thinking that.
That level of incorporation, what Anne and I have done is we make it small for us. And it is, you know, on her birthday or on her death day, it could be, we're going to go to Margie's Candies.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, or we're going to go to Amy's Candy Bar. It's usually ice cream or candy. But there's also her school, the Chicago Waldorf School, built a park, Nora Sun and Moon Park. So sometimes it's going walking through the park. And it's for us in making it small, it's achievable, because that's the hard thing, right? You know, it's such the biggest thing in the world that just happened. And yet you're still here as a human being, just trying to make these steps. And this is the tension in your book. Your tension in your book is this incredible technology that's not going away, people. It's not going away. And then, you know, how do we hold on to what's sacred with this? And you, the way you do it is through some, what I would call gorgeous framing. So you talk about Professor Mark Washauer, is that his name?
Yeah.
Who says the best toy for a child is 90% child and 10% toy. I have used that line regardless of context. I've used that line with different people, and everyone I say it to stops in their tracks and like, that's amazing. That is a beautiful way to think about everything. 90% child, 10% toy. So tell us why you include that line. I mean, I think I know why, but it really resonated with me.
No, it's, I mean, just to really make concrete, I mean, I think that there's this desire, and I may not be answering the question that you want, but there's this desire for parents to give we want to give everything to our children, mm-hmm. right? And suddenly we see this incredible technology. You almost feel like, oh gosh, I need to allow them access to it. That's how they're going to be ready for the age of AI. When the truth is that the greatest gift, the greatest technology in a child's life is obviously their parents and their human interaction, but also understanding that so much of learning and growth, it happens here in our brain. And AI is now this incredible brain that is clearly, what's clearly happening is we're offloading onto that huge brain, mm-hmm. right? And so even when you have a toy that promises to, you know, build your child's curiosity and be a better alternative to screen time, you're cognitively offloading. So to remind people of this idea, you know, I thought that quote was incredibly powerful, that you need to start, it needs to be in the brain, a little bit in the toy. The more the toy has, the less your brain is getting. And I think that was just a really, you know, brain first, tool second. So,
yeah, I'm pretty sure we had baby Einstein when
we did too.
Okay. Are you telling me the science doesn't back that up?
Yeah, no, it's what that's what the, I mean, listen, also the story of the age of AI is that our imperfections and our missteps as parents, and we all mess up, your kids are still going to be fine, right? I mean,
right.
It's a marathon, not a sprint. But yeah, no, I think what is so important to understand is human brain development. Children learn through relationships, just like improv. Children learn through the back and forth, messy interaction. And, you know, long ago, this woman, the researcher, Patricia Kuhl, really showed that children don't learn from screens and from one way interactions. And she did this really cool study where little babies were exposed to Mandarin speakers in person. And they started, these English American children started hearing the Mandarin sound. But when they had the same Mandarin speakers on a screen, they learned nothing. And the reason being is that the children's brain development has something that she calls the social gate. It only learns from other humans, traditionally, mm-hmm. right? That back and forth interaction. And it was a really powerful way for the brain to make sure it concentrated on the human teacher, because otherwise there's a lot that can distract you. And so baby Einstein was, you know, who was named Einstein. So it promised parents, your kids are going to be brilliant. Yeah. And we all bought into it because we want to do right by our kids. But the research pretty soon showed that, just like Patricia Kuhl's research shows, kids didn't learn from it. In fact, it depressed their language development. But why this moment in time is such an important sort of pivotal moment in time is that baby Einstein didn't open up the social gate. But these new AI technologies, because they're so effective in mimicking this interaction, this social connection, and from birth we want to connect, that this AI can open up a baby's social gate, which means that whatever you're exposing that child to will instruct the brain on how to wire. So we've got to be super careful about what we expose our children to, because it's the foundational wiring that, you know, determines all that learning and ability to do improv in the later years.
Yeah, our son Nick, he's 28. He is a Shakespearean actor living in Atlanta, writer, director, amazing storyteller. But he had a undiagnosed learning disability when he was a kid. But we had him in Waldorf school, no screens, story, play, and he would always, because we have a house full of books, you know. But he it was hard for him to read, but he listened to the Winnie the Pooh and Harry Potter and story tapes every single night. And now he's this Shakespearean actor who has always got a book in his hand. It's, you know, we sort of trusted the process of story and play, and put him in community that was live. And it worked. Nora was completely like Nora was reading like books from like way early, like just like always, you know, ahead in the book. I want to talk about, this is in chapter 8 where you say, quote, in 1902, if you were a parent in America, you were living through one of history's most dramatic technological revolutions, end quote. What happened that was so amazing, and what happened that there might have been a bit of a dark side to that too?
You're talking about the food revolution. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I sort of reflected on what other time period, what other experience can mirror this age of AI, you know, and a lot of people go straight to the recent social media experiment, you know, this mass experiment where we deployed social media and it affected adolescent, you know, mental health, et cetera. And, you know, there is a parallel for sure. And we're not going to sleepwalk into AI because of it. But I think a better parallel is the food revolution, because AI is neither, it's a continuum. It's not just one thing. And so back in the early 1900s, you know, the food innovation occurred, and suddenly the good stuff happened, right? We could start feeding large growing cities. People didn't have to spend all their time, you know, canning and, you know, growing stuff on the farm. They could start, you know, going into the cities and becoming educated and making more money, et cetera. Anyway, so lots of good things happened from it, but there was a dark current to it, because there weren't a lot of guardrails. It was happening so quickly. And so, you know, just as easily in your milk, you could have chalk in it. And, mm-hmm. you know, in the medicine you gave your child for a cough, it would have morphine, arsenic, and green candy. So the lack of regulation, like lots of good stuff happened, some not so good stuff happened. And, you know, obviously that didn't continue. I tell the story of this guy, Wiley, who was a chemist and, you know, really shone a light on, you know, this these not good things happening. Eventually it led to the Pure Food and Drug Act. You know, it took a long time before we got those AI labels, those nutrition labels, so that now you know exactly what you're putting into your body. And, you know, parents didn't have to guess, oh gosh, am I giving arsenic to my child in this candy? Like, we had transparency. So in some ways, and then obviously we get to the ultra processed food, which is part of the story. I won't go into that just at this moment, but there's such parallels because AI is not one thing. I think of it as a continuum. You know, on one side, you've got, you know, whole wheat bread, canned fruit, et cetera. It maintains its nutritious quality. It's good. It's healthy. You can have it. We don't want to start having to grind our own own wheat. But on the other side, we've got things like, you know, Doritos and Twinkies. Occasionally it's okay, but if all we eat, that's not going to be good for us. And in that same way, AI is a continuum. You know, you've got AI that lifts invisible labor from parents so that they don't have to spend all their time making grocery lists and logistics so they can be more present. But then, you know, and then you've got AI that can help you, you know, diagnose early learning differences and give more targeted therapy. Those are great things and medical advances. But then on the, you know, on the ultra processed side of things, you've got these, you know, AI companions, you know, in the form of a plush doll that we have no idea what it does to our children's, you know, relationship formation and understanding what relationships look like, et cetera. So it's a continuum. And so I think the parallels are positive. We need, you know, it's racing so quickly. We need guardrails and regulations, and we need more science, and we need to do it quickly because childhood won't wait. And that's really why I wrote this book, both to think it through myself, but to start giving parents and, you know, policymakers real frameworks to be thinking about this. So,
I mean, that the we're talking like 80 years before we got the ingredients on the back. I mean, so, and that, which is great. We did it 8 decades. The issue, of course, now is the speed that AI is moving. It's not regulated, folks. I mean, this is like, and the problem, of course, is the, I think our government officials, A, don't understand it, and the incentives are there for them not to understand it. Because the economy right now is betting on AI, and, you know, and there's a lot of problems with that, especially with China coming in with the cheaper versions. But yeah, we don't know what we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of like slow your roll is not appealing to a lot of people who are holding the purse strings. And I think that that's, you know, the book is very clear in this, which is like, again, it's not an anti-AI book. It's simply we live in an ecosystem that you know, all of it has to fit together. It all meshes together. And, you know, just like you and I probably, I mean, I don't know when you were a kid. I didn't wear seatbelts when I was a kid. I was in the way back, you know, no seatbelt. So, you know, that, and like, I wouldn't dream of putting my kid in a car without a seatbelt, or a friend or a stranger in a car without a seatbelt. So the examples are all over, and you really use that. And this is also where you introduce the detect method. So I wonder if we should talk a little bit about, you give some people some tools that they can use to kind of like at least try to manage this from a parent inside their home with a child and AI.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I tried very hard to give like practical frameworks that people can use now. Because you're right. I mean, the guardrails and policies are struggling to keep up. Although I want to point out that China is not allowing their children to have access.
Of course they aren't.
So we need to, and not only that, but you know, you mentioned your kids going to Waldorf schools, which are obviously, I feel like everybody should have that opportunity. Because that's exactly where the tech titans are sending their kids.
Yep.
You know, I'll tell the detect method, but I also talk about Salk Jobs, where, you know, we have to look at who's building this and what they're doing with their own children. Because if the bridge builder isn't going over his own bridge or her bridge, you better think about whether or not you want to go over it. But But there are ways. So I put forth something called the detect method that parents and all of us can start looking at technologies, and it, you know, hopefully it gets into your muscle memory of like, is this going to help or is this going to erode? And detect stands for D is what is it designed for? You know, does it interact with the child or does it support me? E is ethics. You know, was the algorithm built with representative populations? T is troubles. Is there evidence of negative impacts on children? E is evidence. You know, it's easy to have marketing, but is there real scientific evidence that it's doing what it should do? C is confidentiality. You know, what happens to your child's data? Is it protected? And lastly is teaching. This is not what does it actually teach your child, but what are the values that are being instilled? And I go through it in much more detail, but it is ultimately a quick way to decide before you decide to allow a new technology into your children's developmental sanctuary.
Yeah, which probably we should have been doing with everything before, you know. So, but again, the power of this thing is the point. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. Before we do that, there was another moment in the book that I thought was really powerful. You write, quote, every labor saving domestic technology in history has come with an unintended consequence, raised expectations. And you go on to say, by the 1970s, despite decades of appliances, women were spending nearly as much time on housework as their grandmothers had in the 1920s. The tools changed, but the expected work remained and even expanded, end quote. This reminds me of a conversation we had with Jess Calarco, who said, the social safety net in the United States is women. Yeah. So I think that this is so true in terms of that issue, which is like, no, it's going to be great for the housewives. It's going to be great for working women. It's like, and no, we're all just doing more work, like women especially. So talk a bit about you including that as a concept in the book.
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things I really sort of advance is this idea of, you know, let's think about AI to allow us more presence as parents. You know, how can it, you know, lift up those invisible and visible labors that pull us away from doing what we want to do, which is, you know, connecting with other people or our children, et cetera. But I also wanted to make sure that we raise the antenna that it doesn't always work out the way unintended consequences seem to be the rule with new technologies, yes. Right? Social media, like it's social. Like if you actually think about it, it feels like it should actually connect us, right? You're connecting with people all over the world, but there's always unintended consequences. So, you know, I shared it in the chapter where I talked about the invisible burdens that parents and teachers, you know, often have that, prevent us from being more connected, as a way to say, this is not Pollyanna. We need to be thoughtful so we don't end up, you know, being pulled more. It's nothing is straightforward in this world, is it, Kelly?
No, it isn't, which is the perfect setup for the last question. So we always ask our guest as the final question for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, this is kind of rule number one, which is when you're making something out of nothing in a group, you get nowhere by saying no. That ends the scene. And you actually don't get that far by saying yes. Just a bunch of people agreeing on stage is very, very boring. So we implore this idea of yes and. And what that means is you accept the reality, no matter what it is, that person gave you, their reality is their reality, and you build upon it. And in doing so, you go to like rather absurd places. And I'm sure the show you came to at Second City is the delight of when you do that, when you take this absurd thing and keep going and twist and turn with it. And then it comes back later in the show in the second act or whatever. And we all go through this in life. And in particular, I know for myself, I say no a lot. And my biggest regrets are my no's. And the biggest joys in my life are these unexpected moments when I was like, yeah. And then what happened? Oh, I just met someone who is a life friend. And even like I tell the story all the time of, I'll tell it to you really quickly. So I'd written the book, Yes And, I quit producing at Second City. And the bosses here were very generous. They sort of said, hey, you're probably unhirable anywhere else. Why don't you take a year to figure out a bridge in or a bridge out? And so I had a year of like making my salary, and I'm like, wow, okay, this is wild. But I didn't know what to do. And my boss, Steve, at the time, who ran the corporate division, because I'd just written this corporate book, but I was the storyteller. I was the creative. I was not necessarily the corporate guy. But he said, you know, you've done tons of partnerships. What if you created a partnership for the corporate division? And it dawned on me that there were books out about the power of negotiation and improvisation. And the people writing it were all professors who didn't know anything about improvisation. And I ended up Googling negotiation professors Chicago. And I emailed the first five professors who came up.
I love it.
Four of whom got back to me right away. All of them wanted to do it. The fifth, like 10 days later, Eugene Caruso sends me an email back. He's like, do you still want to meet? And like old Kelly would have been like, no, I'm going with like my Loyola friend, my Northwestern friend or whatever. But I was in this new space, right? And so I like the yes and guy decided to yes and. And Eugene's like, I'm going to invite my wife, Heather, who's a scientist up here. And Heather Caruso is one of my best friends in the world now, and helped us. We started this whole thing. We started this whole thing of connecting behavioral economics and behavioral science with improvisation. It's the reason you and I are talking today on this podcast is because I yes-anded a meeting that I normally would have said no to, and it resulted in, you know, incredible work, dear friends, all this. It's messy, crazy stuff. And so I can see a bunch of yes-ands inside this book, and I'm happy to have you pull a story from there. But I'm wondering what inspires you for your yes-and story from that.
Well, actually, I've got a yes-and story that connects to behavioral economics as well.
Oh, I love it.
So a number of years after my first husband passed away, there was this brilliant behavioral economist who said he wanted to do research together. And I remember distinctly being in his office, and he had an interest in early childhood. And my whole world is, as you know, about the importance of early childhood, the importance of parents and caregivers and that human connection. And I distinctly remember being in his office, and he said to me, we were talking, I said, you know, I really want to start a center that focuses on this, you know, because it's always been my research, but I want to build a whole scientific, you know, work around it. And he was like, why don't we do it together?
Hmm.
And I looked at him and I was like, what? His name is John List, a very well-known behavioral economist. And I said, let me think about it. Little did I know that it was actually may have been his way of wanting to ask me on a date, because eventually he also became my husband. But but being open to new ways of thinking, I mean, you saw in the beginning of my, I think it's chapter two, is on, you know, behavioral economics and understanding ourselves as a way to understand how we interact with AI and how we move forward. So one of my favorite yes and you can, when you meet John, he will tell you the story, because he literally said, let's start a, when I said I want to start a center, he said, we should do it together. I was literally like almost aghast. I was like, wait, why would I want to do that?
How dare you?
But it's been one of the most wonderful, productive relationships on many different levels. So yeah.
I love that yes and story. The book is called Human Raised, Nurturing Connection, Curiosity, and Lifelong Learning in the Age of AI. Dana, thank you for coming on the pod.
This was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Aridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.